This is Tony with Truth Be Told. Today I'm going to be interviewing Andrew Collins, science and history writer and researcher. We're going to talk about his lecture he did for Contact in the Desert. We're going to be talking about some of the latest developments in ufology field, along with invisible portals, global transdimensional doorways to UFO hotspots. So please enjoy the interview, and the interview is already in progress.
I don't know exactly what it's going to contain. There are supposed leaks, and those leaks will say that, yes, there is stuff out there. We don't know what the hell it is. It could be alien, but it could be other things. I mean, ultimately, you're probably going to get a document, you know, 250 pages, maybe it's a lot longer, saying that. And I think the important thing will be to pick through it word by word, sentence by sentence, and see what they actually do say and see what they admit. And I think that in some ways, unfortunately, it's going to leave the public with more questions than answers.
I think so, too.
Because, you know, we're going to hear that UFOs are real. I don't think that they can now say that they don't exist. But as to what they are, we're going to be in a situation where the public are going to feel let down. And I think that what's important is to say, well, look, you know, what is a UFO? I mean, I know this is a very basic question, but it does need to be answered, because most people have the idea that we're talking about flesh and blood aliens coming down here, you know, on spaceships made of metal or whatever they're made of. And they come down here, they land, they do things, their occupants get out, and they get back in and they fly back to another planet. And we now know that's just such an oversimplification that by accepting that and by going along that path, you're not going to get anywhere, really, because if this was true, we'd know a lot more about UFOs because of the research that's been done over the last 70 years. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that what we should be looking at is the fact that this phenomenon exists. It manifests out of somewhere, possibly some kind of multidimensional environment, parallel worlds, parallel existences, and is in our space-time, if you like, within our physical reality for a very short period of time. It interacts with us. It has some kind of relationship to the human mind and human consciousness. And that, in many ways, affects what we see and how we interpret what we see. But then it vanishes and disappears. You know, we're left to try and interpret what's going on. And as I said, for the last 70 years, that's been purely that we're dealing with physical aliens, and that's it. And obviously, we've got, you know, programs like Ancient Aliens, which obviously I take part in,
right,
that are trying to, you know, put forward the idea that these aliens have been with us since the beginning, you know, certainly for thousands of years. And you know, they possibly have influenced the rise of human civilization. But once again, I think that this is an oversimplification, that even if we were visited in the past, and I mean, Carl Sagan, for instance, the great cosmologist, you know, he wrote a paper that was published in 1964 that, you know, was in a scientific journal that concluded that we would have been visited in the past on many occasions by extraterrestrials. So if Carl Sagan says that this was the case, you know, you've got, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, you'd be stupid not to take it seriously. But as I said, if we go down the route where we see all of these UFOs as the product of nuts and bolts spaceships coming down here, you know, containing flesh and blood aliens, you know, we're not going to get the right answers, in my opinion. We have to broaden our horizons as to what's going on and look at the science of things like quantum mechanics, quantum realities and worlds, and, you know, accept the possibility that we could be visited by something else, something that's existing and coexisting with us all the time, and somehow manifests into our reality before returning from whence it came.
And I love that you said the simplification, because we have for so many years think that it's a spacecraft. They fly millions of miles to get here just to observe us. But I think what's really important is, I'm sure scientists and military and people like many of us, it's not even that aliens exist. It's how they get here. And I think the portals and the interdimensional and, you know, transdimensional is really, it makes more sense than just flying millions of miles across space to get here. And I asked this question before, how close do you think we are as human beings to opening up those portholes for ourselves?
I think we're quite a long way away from that, in all honesty. But I think if we start to understand the science behind them, mm-hmm. Then at least we might know where they are or right. where they might appear. And by knowing that, we can predict what type of phenomena is going to be associated with them. Hmm. I mean, I believe that around the planet, possibly in every country of the world, we have what we call points of contact. They go under various different names. You'd call them portals, window right. areas, vortex locations, or whatever, mm-hmm. where not just strange phenomena, but mysterious lights, light forms, and more structured UFOs are seen on a regular basis. And I think that the ancients were very much aware of these points of contact and deliberately sought them out. They deliberately built their stone, earthen and wooden monuments in the proximity of them to in some way interact with this phenomena for some kind of benefit. And that benefit, I think, was technical sophistication that helped develop human civilization. But I don't necessarily think that we're talking again about physical aliens getting out and talking to us.
Right.
I think that this is something to do with an impact on human consciousness. Hmm. In other words, by entering into altered states, by entering into dream sequences, by connecting with this phenomena, it somehow updates us, if you like. It gives us downloads of information. Mm-hmm. And with that comes new technical innovations. And the next book that I've got coming out, which is going to be called Origins of the Gods, again done with Greg Little. And actually, it's got a foreword by Eric von Daniken as well, looks at these ideas and basically suggests that we have evidence that the place where the foundations of shamanism took place 400,000 years ago.
Oh, wow.
At a place called the Kezem Cave in what is today Israel, that the people there quickly became the most sophisticated, innovative people on the planet at the time. Now, tell me that there's not a link between them inventing shamanism and them becoming technologically advanced very quickly. Mm-hmm. Because in the same area, as I will show, mysterious lights and light forms have been seen for not just hundreds, but thousands of years. And if they've been seen for thousands of years, these objects, this strange phenomena, almost certainly have been there all the way along, you know, and that they were there 400,000 years ago, just as they are with us today and are still being seen. And to me, what this says is that, you know, our most distant ancestors were very much aware of this phenomena, and they sought out places where they took place to deliberately interact with them. You know, in many ways, we are looking at ideas that could give us information about the true ancient aliens.
Well, do you believe portholes were naturally created through just, you know, the magnetic field, or was the, because it seems pretty precise on where these portals, we'll call them portals, but they can be called.
Yeah, I mean, portals is a good name, but yeah. Obviously it's the best part of pop culture.
Right.
People know it better. Scientific level, we would call them places of extreme electromagnetic or magnetic anomaly.
Right.
And yes, you're right, that we are dealing with places that have magnetic variations that fluctuate and probably caused by extreme geology to do with minerals, certain types of rocks, obviously certain types of metals in the soil that produce what you'd commonly refer to as electricity. And electricity is essentially the flow of subatomic particles called electrons. And those electrons are incredible things. I mean, you know, they can gather together, form magnetic fields around them themselves, and become so energetic, so excited, that they burst into light, basically. They become balls of light, objects of light. And these are seen, obviously, very close to the ground. They're seen in the air. And they are most obviously associated with these points of contact around the world. I mean, you know, I mean, if you want a famous, you know, portal, we're talking about places like Skinwalker Ranch in Utah, where this phenomena has been seen for hundreds of years and ideally probably thousands of years. But we've got places in Britain, for instance, there's a place called Benton in Yorkshire, which is, you know, the British version of Skinwalker Ranch. Strange phenomena, lights, cryptids, weird time anomalies, you know, things like that have been going on for decades. And again, there seems to be historical evidence as well going back that this phenomena has been there all the way along. And what's so interesting about Benton, for instance, is that the people that built all the stone circles around Britain, like Stonehenge and Avebury, also were in this area and deliberately tried to enhance the landscape to connect in some way with this phenomena. I mean, they built the largest standing stone there, which is about 30 feet tall. They built incredible mounds, and they also constructed a linear earthwork that cuts right the way through the landscape. It's 2.5 miles long, 100 feet across and 100 feet deep, that seems to sever a triangular area of land where all this phenomena actually takes place, as if they were like trying to contain it in one area. And I find this incredible because, you know, it suggests that the ancients were aware of connections with this phenomena, which we're only now, only in the last 10, 20 years, beginning to understand ourselves. And as I said, if you keep looking at these, this phenomena as purely extraterrestrial, all of this is not going to mean anything. Right. Whereas quite clearly, there is a geological factor involved. There's an electromagnetic factor. There's the opening up of portals that seem to be associated with these light forms. And these light forms seem in themselves to be almost portals. You know, what I will show in the book is that there's strong evidence, scientific evidence, that they themselves act as portals into multidimensional environments. And, you know, this is what I'll be talking about, you know, in my lecture, At Contact in the Desert, which I believe is going out tonight. So, you know, if people want to, you know, hear more about this subject, look that out.
Well, let me ask you this. I can understand how we might be able to find, you know, locations around the Earth because of our technology that we have, through satellites, through, you know, gauge, whatever we have technology. But how in the hell did they, you know, thousands of years ago find these portals? How, without any technology other than just their bodies, their minds, how in the hell would they find that those portals?
Well, I think we have to accept that the people of the past were much more in tune with the Earth than we are today. You know, they were able to connect with it. They had a much better psychic awareness, with no stigmas relating to it. So they would have been drawn through psychic visions, dreams, through portents and signs. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when they got into the areas that they felt that, you know, they were in the right place, they'd be looking for the appearance of the lights. They were looking for those lights. They, you know, they were looking for the places where they occurred.
Right.
And once they found those, they would know that this was the right place to settle. And they would then create their, you know, their settlements, their communities, which probably would have been just a little way away from where the phenomena occurs. I mean, I won't say it won't overlap to where right. they are, but the main, sort of central focus would probably be somewhere that they could look out towards. It would probably be a holy mountain, a particular hill, maybe even a basin, a valley basin, where they could overlook and see the phenomena, and they could interact with it, at their discretion. Because I think that from, the work that I've done, and Greg Little in the book, who looks at the whole thing from a Native American point of view, is that the Native Americans were very much aware of this phenomena, but they were also quite wary of it. And their interactions with it were had to be on their terms, and that they would do the right rituals and ceremonies to interact with it, when they decided to do that.
Right.
So in other words, there was a certain amount of control that they needed so that this essentially didn't overtake their lives and make them mad, if you like. I mean, because, you're dealing with a phenomena which through, you talked about the experience that your family had and yourself, where was it your sister, had this strange experience after you saw this object, and then something happened, something occurred. Well, if you can imagine stuff like this going on thousands of years ago, how would the ancients have related to this? They would have known that they're dealing with something which you don't mess with. You interact with it when you want, mm-hmm. Further innovations, connections, experiences, maybe even to see the ancestors. Because the other question comes is, how did the ancients relate to this phenomena? How did they identify it? We identify it today as aliens and extraterrestrials. The ancients wouldn't have done that. They'd have seen it almost certainly in association with great ancestors, the return of the right. ancestors, but also the return of the animal spirits as well, the spirits of the animals that they would have killed on the hunt, that they would have felt that they could interact with them and that they could appear to us. And that brings us very nicely onto the idea of things like skinwalkers. Why is Skinwalker Ranch called Skinwalker Ranch? And the fact is that the skinwalker is the supernatural form that a so-called witch or shaman of the Navajo would take to enter into journeys in the other world. And one of the main forms that the Navajo witch would take is the wolf. In fact, the same word for wolf in Navajo is the same word for shaman, or witch. So in other words, it's the same thing. And so essentially what happened was that in the 19th century, there was tribal wars between the Navajo and the other local tribe, who is the Ute. And the Ute took over an area which was seen as like a no man's land, like a sacred territory, which we now know today as the Yuntar Basin, which includes Skinwalker Ranch. And strange phenomena started to occur, including the appearance of these skinwalkers, these strange, almost like werewolf-like creatures, that have been seen in the modern day as well. And the Ute believed that they were being cursed by the Navajo. And that's still the current belief to this day.
Oh, wow.
Purely because they were seeing these creatures here and there. And they thought that they were the Navajo witches having taken the form of a skinwalker to curse them. But this doesn't happen in isolation. At Bempton, for instance, in Yorkshire, in England, you also see these same werewolves, these same canine-headed bipeds. So what's going on there? Well, in this very same area, you have Britain's Göbekli Tepe. It's not much to see, I'm afraid, but it's the same age as Göbekli Tepe, and it was the main centre of shamans in Britain 11,000 years ago. It's a place called Star Car. And here, shamanism involving the red deer, but also the wolf, took place. So in other words, you had shamans once again taking the form of wolves and, you know, going off into otherworldly environments and possibly being seen by people, you know, in the living.
Right.
And what's so interesting is that these werewolves are being seen in the exact same location as where this place, this Star Car, is located. And the local investigator in the area by the name of Paul Sinclair, you know, made the link between the two. And I think he's absolutely on the money. And quite clearly, you've got very similar things occurring at Skinwalker Ranch. And these are just two examples. And what this is a product of is human consciousness interaction. In other words, you know, we interact with the environment, the very subtle quantum energy matrixes, and we affect what's going on, not just in the here and now, but because on a quantum level, time doesn't really exist in the way that we perceive the passage of time, you know, in an atomic way, that in many ways, those shamans taking the form of wolves 11,000 years ago at Star Car or a couple of hundred years ago at Skinwalker Ranch are still doing it now. And that's why we're seeing this phenomena. It doesn't explain everything, but it helps us to start to understand what's going on.
Oh, that's great. I mean, that is so fascinating. And one thing that popped into my head is, you know, over thousands of years, you know, we've had polar ice shifts or what do you call it? You know,
well, axis shifts or something.
Yeah, something like that. Where
magnetic field shifts.
Where when these shifts happen, it throws off these ley lines or throws off some of these portals. Something that was maybe 10,000 years ago may not be in the same location when it comes to these polar, not portals.
Yeah, so, I understand where you're going.
Yeah, there we go. So,
yeah, I mean, well, look, here's the facts. Yeah, I mean, quite clearly, you know, there are shifts in the magnetic field.
Yes.
You know, to
that's
10,
where I went.
20, you know, degrees or more, possibly. But, of course, the actual geology of the Earth is still essentially the same.
Got
you know,
it.
We still have huge fields of quartz or copper or iron or, you know, the type of rock that can produce electricity through the process known as piezoelectricity. And this, so in other words, this still generates the same energy. But what's happening, of course, is that the shifts and changes in the magnetic field will change the strength of this activity. So it could make it stronger or it could make it weaker. So, yeah, this could determine or whether one of these portals or points of contact is active for the next few hundred years or whether it becomes dormant again. But quite clearly, probably, you know, give it another few hundred years, it could become active again as those magnetic shield, those fields shift once more. So, you know, there is a science here, but to try and better understand this, we have to monitor places like Skinwalker Ranch or Bempton or similar places around the world with scientific instrumentation. It has to be there, you know, not for just a few hours waving around electronic field meters, you know, like you see on television, which is rubbish, by the way. You know, that it means absolutely nothing. But you have to be monitoring these places 24/7. You know, possibly for a minimum of two weeks, 4 weeks, you know, on various different levels, so that if phenomena does occur, you can see the changes in the different, you know, fields. You not just from an electromagnetic or electrostatic point of view, but also from the point of view of sound. What we've also found is that very low frequency sound seems to be a very important component in all of this, that in these points of contact, these portal areas, that you'll find that there are unusual bursts of low frequency sound. usually in the range of about 50 hertz, but they can be as far down as 20 to 10 hertz, which takes you into what's known as infrasound. And the importance about infrasound is that it's been used over the last 20 years to actually dismiss and debunk paranormal activity, because it's often been found that there's a source of infrasound in, let's say, a haunted house. You know, it might be coming from a faulty electronic, installation or something like that. Right. So a skeptic will go in and say, well, look, that's I can see that's generating infrasound. That's the explanation. That's why people are seeing ghosts. That's why they're feeling presences. That's why they're having weird ones, you know. But that's but the trouble is that by doing that, you're throwing the baby out the bathwater, because yes, of course, infrasound enhances paranormal activity. But that's it. That's the answer. It enhances it. It's not something that's purely producing it and causing some kind of false echo. You know, and I think that the ancients were very much aware of it. I've written articles on, let's say, Stonehenge and that area and the recent discoveries there that would seem to suggest that the monuments there were sonic temples, quite literally, to generate very low frequency sound. And this was not for some kind of performance, you know, the producing of some kind of concert where people would be standing around the outside clapping at the end of, each song. It's not a thing to do with that. The sound would be such low frequency that it would be pulsated throughout the earth itself. Because the one thing that we know about very low frequency sound and infrasound is that it's carried through the earth, through the soil, for great distances, for miles. You know, so that And also that very low frequency sound can be used to trigger piezoelectric activity within rocks. There's a massive relationship between the creation of electricity in rocks and the production of sound. The two are interlinked. You can use sound to produce produce piezoelectricity, and use piezoelectricity to create sound. The two go hand in hand. And that's incredibly important. And somehow, once again, intuitively, the ancients would seem to have been aware of this and incorporated sound into their ancient sites. Again, I talk all about this, you know, in my lecture for Contact in the Desert, go into it in great detail. And those ancients would seem to have known not just that sound was important, but what frequencies to use, and incorporated those frequencies into the dimensions of those monuments, including Stonehenge itself.
Well, if people can see this, they can actually see Stonehenge here. And I'm curious, I mean, just from the average Joe, they're like, how in the hell do you get sound out of these big rocks? I guess it may not make sense to a lot of people of how these rocks create sound.
Well, I mean, the rocks themselves are not creating the sound that's at Stonehenge. There was a recent study done by the Acoustics Research Centre at Salford University in Manchester.
The acoustics, yeah.
That found that the positions of the stones, shapes, everything about them was conducive for them having been used to increase the acoustics of the location. And as I said, this would have been done by certain types of instruments. I mean, one of the suggestions was some kind of horns, very low frequency horns, very much like the Tibetan horns known as the lur, which is a kind of like L-U-R, I believe, how it's spelled. But just nearby, you've got a place called Durrington Walls, and they found this huge great circle of these massive drum-like pits. I can't remember the exact size. I think they're about 32 feet across by about 16 feet deep. And their size is conducive to acoustics, to producing very specific acoustics in the low frequency and infrasound range. And these are in a huge, great circle. I mean, I think it's about 2.5 miles across.
Oh, my gosh.
Around another massive monument known as Durrington Walls. And this is only about, you know, a couple of miles at the most from Stonehenge. And the geometry in the distances between all of these sites, within the dimensions of the actual monuments, all of them seem to reflect an interest in very specific sound frequencies.
I'm gonna show this picture, and I'm sure you've been to the Integratron.
I
have to say, before I went to the Integratron, and speaking of acoustics, I never really thought, you know, I believed in portals, but I didn't really understand it until I actually went to the Integratron and experienced the music, and you know, you're kind of going to a meditation state. It was like time stood still, but it went like a flash, where I just blinked my eyes and it felt like it was already over. And I actually did see, maybe because I was at contact at the time, but I did see aliens. I saw like some type of alien creatures, if you want to call them, you know, other dimension, creatures. But so you're saying that the acoustics is really what can create a portal itself.
Well, I mean, not on its own.
Well, because it has minerals and everything added to it.
It can help trigger,
right?
You know, the subtle flow of what we call electricity, of electrons,
right?
You know, could themselves then materialize and become these light forms creating. Using a substance known as plasma. Plasma is a full state of matter. Essentially, it is excited electrons that are generating subatomic particles of light called photons. And they're all held within, you know, these magnetic fields, self-created and magnetic fields. And, you know, sometimes these are visible, sometimes they're not. You know, you can get plasmas that are actually invisible. Some of them are quite dense as well. But, I mean, that's out in the landscape. I mean, obviously, with the Integratron, the important thing about that is that it was invented, created by a guy called George Van Tussel.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, he is a classic example of a so-called contactee during the 1950s. You know, he had contacts with the Space Brothers, as they were probably known at the time. But what's more important is that, you know, he would go into the giant rock, which obviously is somewhere else very close and to the heart of contact in the desert. And, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people would come along, you know, to try and watch for UFOs, you know, sky watches. But he would enter into a trance and communicate with what he considered to be, you know, the space beings, the Space Brothers. And it was through these contacts that he got this technology. And he was able to create the Integratron. Now, think of this happening in the past. Think of our ancients doing exactly the same thing at places like Stonehenge. Did it actually inspire them to create places like Stonehenge? You know, was that not an Integratron of its own generation?
Right.
And did that information not come from similar communications, possibly during altered states, with what the ancients would have referred to as the ancestors or the animal spirits or whatever it was that they interpreted these intelligences? And of course, as I said, we don't have to see these intelligences specifically as flesh and blood aliens. You know, they could be trans-dimensional intelligences that are interacting with us and have been doing so since the beginning. As I said, I mean, I take it back in the next book to 400,000 years. And if you can take it back that far, you can take it back to our earliest ancestors in Africa 2 million years ago. And that's something that I also, you know, touch upon in the book as well.
And how did you, I mean, did you have your own experiences? Like I said at the beginning, it's, we've all, you know, a sighting, an abduction, you know, a book, or how did you get started into this genre of ufology and just, I mean, made it your career, really?
Well, I mean, it's quite a weird story, really. I mean, firstly, my interest when I was a rather obsessive child was actually aircraft, by essentially spotting aircraft. And I remember one night, I was lying in bed and I saw this light go, you know, through the sky. And I thought, I don't know what the hell aircraft that is. and this just sort of, you know, changed everything, really, because I couldn't catalogue it. And that made me realise that it was a UFO. And I decided to learn more about UFOs. And I became an investigator for the British UFO Research Association. And I started going around interviewing people who had seen, this sort of stuff.
Right.
And the one thing that came out really early on, and this is the thing that really threw me, is that there seemed to be some kind of psychic link between the witnesses to close encounters and the phenomena that they observed. In other words, the phenomena was responding to them in some way, almost as if it could hear what the people were thinking in their minds and responding in that way. And I'll be honest, at first I thought these people must be mad. I mean, and they're just imagining it, and that, you know, they were mental or something like that. But when I realized that these people truly were telling the truth and I got to know them, I realized that we had a problem here, because up to that point, I thought that UFOs were simply nuts and bolts spacecraft. But, you know, I mean, if we see, you know, a standard aircraft crossing the skies, you know, like an airliner, there's no way that we can communicate with it and it can respond back to us by moving or changing direction. It just doesn't happen. So I began to realize that these phenomena are not simply, you know, nuts and bolts spacecraft. They are almost entities. They are living beings in their own right. Now, whether they have occupants inside them or whether that we create those occupants by interacting with that phenomena so that we see these, you know, bipedal beings coming out of them or whatever, I'm not sure. That's a much longer conversation, but I realized at that point that we were looking at things wrongly, and that if we just assume that, you know, Roswell style spaceships can come down and crash and we can pick up bits of metal and things like that, we're never really going to get any answers. And coming back to where we started this journey tonight, well, not for you, but for me, is that, you know, if the US military, if they go in with the idea that we are simply dealing with nuts and bolts spacecraft and that they try and find proof of that and proof that these are alien hardware as opposed to hardware from, you know, some other foreign military power,
right,
they're not going to come up with any answers, I don't think. You know, you are not, when this report is released, you are not going to read that there is pieces of a spaceship at Area 51. You are not going to read that.
No.
You know, what you're going to read is that, yeah, there's some weird stuff out there. You know, we've got it on video. You've seen the videos. They may even release new ones. And we don't know what they are. That's what they're going to say. They're going to say, yes, they could be aliens. But yes, equally, they could be this, that, and the other. And that's essentially all of this. That's all you're going to get in this report. They're going to give you the bare minimum, whatever the answer is anyway. So people are always going to assume that there's some kind of conspiracy going on. But, you know, if only I could just say to those, you know, those US military people doing this report, look at it differently. You know, look at it that we are dealing with a phenomena that's coexisted with us since the beginning and may be transdimensional in nature, may be able to interact with the human mind to actually take on whatever form we almost want it to be. Because if we are dealing with multidimensional intelligences, by their sheer nature, we will never see what they really look like, because we're three-dimensional beings. We cannot see four-dimensional environments. Mm. You know, the ancients might have been able to see slightly more into that four-dimensional spectrum than we could, but we can't. So all we would see is like, yeah, blinding lights that we interpret in terms of angels or aliens or light beings or something like this. We're never going to fully see what's in front of us. And again, we need to accept that if we're to try and understand what's going on scientifically and if we're to get any real answers to the UFO mystery.
Well, we touched on, you know, a lot of what you're going to be speaking in your lecture, but in the lecture itself, can you tell us what, I mean, without going into details, because we want to save it for the lecture, but what are you going to be talking about that we didn't discuss here today?
Well, it's all this, exactly this, to be honest. thinking about it, scanning it, by the way, it is pre-recorded. I don't know if I'm supposed to tell you that. It's everything I've talked about today. But, I mean, look, it's about the concept of trans-dimensional intelligences. That's what I see the UFO beings as being. You know, we have a term for them. We call them N-beings. The N standing for number, as in N-dimensional beings, mm-hmm. because we don't know how many dimensions may be involved. It could be 4, it could be 11, it could be 22, it could be 300. We don't know. So we call them N-dimensional beings or N-beings short. But, I mean, you know, if you use the term trans-dimensional intelligences, that's pretty accurate, I think.
And I think, you know, what you're talking about could answer many of the myths of the world anyway, you know, Bigfoot, werewolves, and all kinds of stuff that we've heard about, we've not necessarily proven other than, you know, sightings. But I think with these trans-dimensional doorways, this could answer a lot of questions that we have been talking about for thousands of years and just never
Absolutely.
Had the... Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, those cryptids, for instance, are real. I mean, you know, they're physical.
Right.
When they're here, they are, you know, probably flesh and blood. They can interact. They can leave footprints. They can possibly even, you know, mutilate animals, you know, kill animals or eat carcasses, you know, create animal carcasses. But then they vanish back from whence they mm-hmm. came. And, you know, we call them reality hoppers, basically. You know, in other words, they're coming from another reality, a parallel world, parallel dimension. I mean, maybe even the future, who knows, or the past.
Right.
And they're temporarily physical in our world for a short period of time, but for some reason, they can't stay here. They have to go back from whence they came. And I suspect, you know, it's not a case of, you know, they're there and suddenly they're pulled back. I just think that things switch around and suddenly they're not there anymore. You know, you won't even be aware of that transition. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've often heard reports where cryptids have been followed, even at Skinwalker Ranch, where they've been following the tracks of these creatures, and suddenly they stop and they don't carry on.
Right.
And I think, you know, this could be where the switch comes and they're no longer in our physical reality. They're back. They've gone back to whence they came. And I think that there's a possibility that more higher intelligent beings could also come through those same portals. And some of them may well be extraterrestrial. We don't know, because we don't know where these portals go to. You know, they can go to multidimensional environments, parallel worlds, but they may link, just like black holes and white holes, you know, with other parts of the galaxy or other parts of the universe, or even in parallel universes. We don't know. I mean, we haven't got all the answers. Let's be honest here. But we have to start looking at this from a new paradigm perspective, I think, to get real answers, to bring all of these different topics together, everything from poltergeist houses to cryptids to strange phenomena, to UFOs, to aliens, to multi-dimensional environments, they're all part of one big picture. None of them are unrelated to each other.
I mean, we only have just a few minutes left, but I've been watching, you know, I don't know if anybody's out there is a Marvel fan, but they have a new on Disney Plus. It's called Loki. So, you know, Thor's stepbrother. And, but it, they have the, it's a, they have them timekeepers. And Loki, it, he, when he stole the Tesseract, that he threw off the time and the, and he, so that he was in a variant. And so these timekeepers come back and they have to correct time. And so it, it kind of reminds me of what's happening now. Like we've heard many times that we've, they've saved us from nuclear war and stuff like that. It almost sounds like they come back and sometimes let us make our mistakes, but correct time so we don't necessarily destroy ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think if these beings, these intelligences are there, because they are outside of normal time,
mm-hmm.
they're not just with us in the here and now.
Right.
They've always been with us, you know, for since we were a baby and to the point that we die.
Right.
You know, in other words, if you go out tonight and you see a UFO, that intelligence is not just connecting with you now, it's connecting with you across your whole life,
right.
because it exists outside of normal time.
It's kind of like guardians. So, it's, yeah, guardians.
You know, so in a way, you know, they are keepers of the timeline.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can call them whatever terms you want. You know, I mean, one of the terms that we use is Morpheans. That, you know, these beings have always existed to keep us on a certain timeline that started with the beginning of the universe and goes all the way through to the end of the universe.
Right.
I mean, the way to look at this is that you think of your favorite film. You know, you watch it 20, 30 times.
Right.
Maybe more. And what if you were watching it and one day, you know, two important people don't meet in that film? And that sends everything off onto a different course. And, you know, what maybe one of complete destruction. I mean, you know, if you had the ability to do it, would you not try and bring those two people together?
Yeah, of course.
You know, just like in Back to the Future, where, you know, was it Marty McFly dresses up as Darth Vader?
Right.
Was it convinces? I can't remember the full story, but, you know, he has to bring together, you know, of his parents or whatever it is to do so that the story, the plot can happen and he can exist.
Right.
And in a way, it's the same thing. I think that these keepers of the timeline, you know, could well intervene at certain points, as you say, to stop us exterminating ourselves or to push us in certain directions, you know, or to help evolve us as a species.
Right.
And if that is the case, it's been going on all the way through. You know, not just
human
beings, you know, Homo sapiens, but Neanderthals, the Denisovans, mm-hmm. who I've written about, Homo erectus, right the way back to the very first guys that picked up, you know, a stone and made it into a tool, you know, or lit the first fire
mm-hmm.
2 million years ago. You know, think they're about 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Right.
You know, I mean,
the
black monolith appearing.
Yeah.
And affecting human consciousness into creating the first piece of technology, which obviously happened to be a weapon. But, you know, the point is there. I think that all of this has actually happened and continues to affect us today. And, you know, we're all a part of that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we're all a part of this and we can all connect with these M-beings, with these transdimensional intelligences, you know, by simply believing that they exist, that they're there, and by going out into the landscape, doing sky watches, you know, trying to interact with this phenomena. Because I think that if you try hard enough, it will interact with you back.
I agree. And unfortunately, that's our time. And Andrew, thank you so much for being part of this little interview here today, and congratulations on your lecture. How do people find you and find your books?
AndrewCollins.com. AndrewCollins.com. All as it sounds. Or obviously find me on social media. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Facebook and Twitter.
And if you're watching,
the links for that are on AndrewCollins.com.
Perfect. And then make sure you visit his lecture coming up today. And make sure it's here, right here on contactinadesert.com. And also, I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. You can go to Truth Be Told Worldwide for the website. Follow us on YouTube. Watch all my channels. And then Instagram, Truth Be Told Paranormal. Until next time, thank you guys. And enjoy Contact in the Desert this weekend.
Well, he looks like...